file a problem. I'll be glad when this meeting's over because it'll be the last of these stories. We've had a real picnic this year, and these things have to be faced, so we'll tell this story now and be done with this business and get back to some good solid Bible study this evening and tomorrow and Sabbath. I say. Uh-huh. Well, we're glad to see him, no question about that. Now, I first met the Silver family back in 1966 when Brother Reese, I also met Brother Reese that year for the first time, and he took the message up and was very anxious that we go across to Montreal and see Helmut and Ruth Seiler, which we did. Quite a crossing that was. We lit out in from Saskatchewan, way up at Mayfair in the far northwestern area of it, from the home of the Rogers, and we travelled from there all day and all night and all day non-stop. I think we did 2,500 miles in that period. And you imagine the three of us packed into a Volkswagen. That was a trip, believe me. And then we decided to take one night out for sleeping, and we finally arrived at Silas the next night again. And when I got there, I found Brother Silas in the very, very deepest depths of discouragement and despair. He is a man who has a tremendous passion for work. In fact, that's a characteristic of the German race. They call it Arbeitslust. It means a lust for work. Arbeit is the German word for work, yes, Arbeit. Meine Arbeit is my work, and they call it Arbeitslust, which means a lust for work. And I must take my hat off to the German race, because I think you've seen photographs of what Berlin and Hamburg and Frankfurt and those places were like after the Second World War. They were just razed to the ground. And you travel through Germany today and you find the most prosperous country in the world. So much so the German mark needs to be revalued, and let's talk about that. And in all my travels throughout the length and breadth of Germany, I found only one building in Nuremberg with a few bullet marks from the wars. All the rest, you just wouldn't know a war had ever happened. You just wouldn't know it. Not a scar left in the whole country. And just imagine rebuilding a whole nation in a matter of less than 20 years. Those people are workers. And Brother Seiler is a worker, make no mistake about that. Well, he's also a very talented man. No question of that either. And there are people who don't mind what sacrifices they make, how they scrimp and save and work themselves to the bone and live on the very least in order to get out what they're doing. And he'd been acting this way in relationship to the church, but the difficulty was this, that instead of just working for the church and with the church, apparently he wanted to impose his will on the church and have them just do what he thought they should do. And apparently he felt that he had an experience independent of the church and superior to the church. I recognize that better now looking back. And he found that the church just wouldn't work with him at all and didn't want his tapes and efforts in any shape or form. And he had in mind at that time going to South America and setting up a shortwave radio station in connection with which he would build thousands upon thousands of single channel transistor receivers, little tiny bitty things, you know, about as big as a box of chalk like this, but capable of receiving only one station, his station. So that when he beamed his programs, Bible programs and so forth, all the South Americans who'd be given or sold these little sets cheaply would only hear the gospel coming through. Quite a plan, but tremendously ambitious, believe me. Yes, right. Well, he heard this message and he took hold of it in a big way, and it was a thing by halves, and I read the literature, and then Dr. Von Drun in Germany wrote across and suggested to him that he might like to translate, or first of all, and asked him not to translate, but simply to set up in type the material for offset printing in Germany, specifically some of Von Drun's writings, and also Bonnish to Deliverance, and one or two other of our little booklets, Acceptable Confession, and so on. Well, the Silas then wrote down to us in Australia and offered to not only translate, not only types of it, but also translate the material for us, and we would print it and send it off to Germany. And so a definite working contract was arranged. They would translate and set the material in type. They'd email the material down to us. We would photograph it, as you saw the other evening, and run it through the press and ship it off to Europe. So we started. And first of all, they worked on living righteously, which is called in German Gerechtes Leben. And one by one and two by twos, the translated work came down to us and we received it. printed it, and shipped it off to Europe as fast as we got it.
Well, this went along quite nicely until the middle of last year, around about June, and then, for no stated reason on their part, suddenly no more of the material came. It wasn't very long, of course, inasmuch as nothing came to us, we couldn't send anything off to Europe. It wasn't long before the European folk were writing urgently for the next numbers to carry on from the ones which they had already received. We'd write back and say, well, we're still waiting on Silas to send it down. We don't know what they're doing, but we guess it'll come here in due time. Please be patient. In the meantime, we wrote to Silas and told them we were waiting, but they sent no explanation, no reply, and we were kept on waiting. Well, about that time, as you recall, I came to America once again. We had our camp meeting out here in Oakdale, and I went down on to Arizona, up to Colorado, and about there, I think it was, I got from the Silas an urgent letter addressed to me, telling me on no account to buy the Heidelberg Press until we had seen them. Now, I wrote back and said that, as far as I could tell, we didn't plan to buy the Heidelberg anyway until I returned from Europe at the end of the year, and I was sitting in the meantime, so there was nothing to panic about. So I continued on my way across America to eventually reach Montreal in November last year. The weather turned quite bitterly cold and was snowing the night I arrived, and the snow lay on the ground practically all the time I was there. Now, I'd like to go back at this point and explain to you a little bit of the way in which we have progressed in the upbuilding of the publishing work in Australia, which where it finds its main headquarters and centre at the moment. Back in 1964, in the little town of Grafton, as you saw in the films the other night, we had a camp meeting pictured in those two photographs which were lying here on the table, which have now gone back upstairs again. As you saw, there were very, very few folk present, maybe four or five families altogether, a little company about the same size as the company we have here today, and generally speaking, just about as poor in this world as good. In fact, poorer, because Australians, generally speaking, have a much lower wage scale than American folk do. Well, I had been across America that year, and everywhere I had gone, folk had said to me, do you have this message in print? And I would have to say, no, I'm sorry, we don't. But I was impressed with the fact that the printed page was an essential weapon in the onward march of the message. So I came back from America that year quite firmly convinced that there ought to be a printing press in our possession and that it should be printing our material and leaving it behind wherever the living preacher went. And so it was that I came home with this conviction, and actually in Sydney, where I stayed over a couple of days, Margaret was there to meet me. We went down and took a good long look at a multilith and a verityper, and we got an idea of what they would cost, and we're staggered to find we'd need $5,000 just to get started. Just to get started, $5,000. Well, I said to my wife, we won't be getting the printing press for a long time. Such was the height and length of my faith. So we came to camp meeting, but I came home, and we lived at Moolumbah at the time, and I think about the first night I met with the folk, Brother Ludlow called me aside after me and said, you know, but in the general little discussion, he said, I believe we ought to have a printing press and start printing this message. And I was astonished to find that God was working his mind at the same time as he was working my mind, and Brother Race chimed in and agreed. Well, I went down to Grafton, I had some contact with Grafton anyway, and I think they may have written me a letter, and they said, down here, the word came, we believe it's time we had our own printing press. And up in Palm Woods, in Queensland, the folk there had the same conviction. And I was tremendously impressed by that, because it thrilled me through and through to find that the truth of these words here in Acts of the Apostles, page 163, was being experienced by us, where it says, God does not give to one person experience independent of his brethren. And I'm a very strong believer in the fact that God speaks to his people, not just an odd individual here and there. Remember the words I read this morning where it says, he does not give to one of his servants an experience independent of and contrary to the experience of the church itself. Neither does he give one man a knowledge of his will for the entire church while the church, Christ's body, is left in darkness. So at the very same time as I was being impressed, with the need to begin a publishing work, so were my brethren in the church generally. Now, I didn't have to convince them, nor they me, We just mutually had arrived at that conclusion under God's leadership. So I then went to work with a will and made a thorough investigation of the different printing presses available and gathered up all kinds of brochures and price lists and details and specifications and came to camp meeting armed with this stack of advertising material. But all the time my heart saying, when the people learn how much it will cost them to start a publishing work, that'll be the end of their dreams and their aspirations and visions. I had something to learn. We came to camp and the question was in their mind, so I laid before them just what it would cost to even begin publishing. As I said, $5,000. And we had, I said to them, $140 in our publishing fund. Well, they said to me without even batting an eyelid, well, they said, go ahead and buy it. I said, did I hear right? Did I hear straight? They said, certainly. They said, if the Lord God of heaven has told you and us, independent of each other, to start a publishing work, then all we have to do is obey God. He'll pay the bill. And that was so obviously logical and reasonable, I couldn't argue with them. Yeah, that's right. 64. Pardon? End of 64. Yeah, that's right. End of 1964, just 5 years ago. Well, at the same camp meeting, we made up our minds as a very fixed and violent principle in regard to this message that we would never, ever have fundraising campaigns or go around begging for money. And as you know, we've come to camp meeting after camp meeting in Germany, and how often have you seen the offering plate pass up and down the row? Not once. How often have you heard money mentioned in the camp meetings? Never. Because we stick to that principle rigidly. And I believe this, that when the Lord God of heaven calls upon us to do a certain thing, then all we have to say is, all right, Lord, you said it, here we go, but you pay the bill. And God always does. And that's the way the work has progressed down through the years. So it was that with $140 in the publishing fund, I went home to Mwollumbah again, and the people went home to their various homes and began scratching in their piggy banks and savings accounts and whatnot. And I still can't believe the fact that within 3 months we paid $5,000 cash for all that equipment and installed it in 3 months. Now, don't you ask me to this day where the money came from. I'm almost inclined to believe that quite often someone would send $20 to the treasury, and by the time it got there, it was $100. Yeah, I was just going to mention that. There was one family who came and offered us £1,000, which is $2,000. When I say $5,000, that's Australian. American, that's $5,500 American dollars. And certainly one family loaned this. They happened to have had a bequest come to them recently, a will, and they loaned us $2,000 of interest-free money. Take us long to pay it back as we needed. We paid it back, I think, over about 3 years, bit by bit. But it saved us interest, which, of course, was as good as a gift, as you might say. Well, as time went by, it became evident to us that this plant that we had bought, the little multilith, the old hand guillotine, and the plate, little plate-making machine, was only a starter, and as the work rapidly grew, it would very, very soon become inadequate for the work that was involved. Well, Sister White tells us that the business of the movement should not be taken up before all the people, but given to the hands of men who are appointed for the purpose. And so there are a number of men of tried and proven experience with whom I normally discuss the business of the movement, do nothing excepting by their counsel. And then in turn, we usually put in the newsletter the decisions made so everyone around the world knows what's going on and can make objections or suggestions as they wish. Point for you folks to remember if you haven't realized it before. Well, we went to work again on the problem very prayerfully, not as an individual, not I on my own, but as a group of men. Mind you, I had to do most of the actual spade work and the actual investigation and keep reporting back to the other men. And it became crystal clear to us that we needed to have a Heidelberg press supported by two or three other components, namely a larger guillotine, a power guillotine, a larger camera, the one you saw in the film the other night, and the guillotine you saw in the film the other night, together with the folding machine which you saw, and the plate-making machine which you saw, and later on a secondary typer. So, having arrived at this conclusion, as a result of prayer and united study on the question, we then didn't rush off impetuously and buy all this equipment. I should mention to a larger building in which to house it all, and you saw the two buildings, the original little one, and now with its full extension makes quite a building. And so we then laid the whole plan before God to be carried out or given up as his providence should indicate. And we just moved no faster than the opening providence of God gave to us each piece of equipment. The first one to come was the guillotine, and that was certainly a godsend, believe me. I wish I had some movie film of the old ones. I'd love you to see Case being on that. It was a hand-operated model, and there was a big six-foot iron handle to it, about an inch and a half in thickness. And when slicing through a ream of paper this thick, poor Kay would jump off the ground and pull this handle down, and he'd swing in the air like Alan does from the top of the trees. And finally the handle would gradually sink down to the paper, and she'd just about lie on the floor when it was completely cut through. It's too bad that we started taking movie film as late as we did. I wish I had some of the pictures of the earlier history of this movement on those films. Well, when the power guillotine came, it's just a matter of pressing two buttons, one with each thumb, which makes it impossible to have one hand in here and press the thumb and catch your fingers off. You have to press two widely separated buttons and a hydraulically operated clamp, and the blade comes in and just slices through the paper just like that, and it's a real child's job. Now, any one of these children, he could operate the machine. So that came first of all. Then came the camera and the light-making frame. And then we had a really wonderful bion that folding machine, which is so operating there tonight so smoothly. It does when the camera's on it anyway. We sometimes have little picnics with it. But we got that for one-third of the new price, and it's just about as good as a new machine. So all that was left now was the Heidelberg. And this was the situation when when I was approaching Silas last year and got this letter which said, urgently, don't buy the Heidelberg unless you've first seen us. And in the meantime, the Silas had begun to print themselves. They hadn't asked our permission. They had just decided they were going to print, so they took our literature and began to print it. And that's right, they decided... They didn't say we're going to change our contract. They just said to themselves, well, we can start printing. And they ignored us in Australia, and we were left high and dry and couldn't fulfill our contracts with Germany. Now, in the meantime, we already had a bad experience with the Silas in this respect, that when the work in Africa opened up at the beginning of last year, that's just about 2 years ago now, somehow, and I'll never know how, but I guess from some German source, Brother Silas secured for himself the addresses of the folk in Africa. We hadn't supplied them, we just hadn't even thought about whether we should or not, we just hadn't supplied them. We weren't obliged to, it was not any requirement of us to give them those addresses. And so they made contact with Brother Luvu, Brother Sesetse, Brother Rubisi, Brother McKeffey, Brother Kasi, and the one down in Port Elizabeth, Manelli, Brother Manelli. And then the next thing they did was to start shipping to print themselves the English Bondage and Acceptable Confession and Living Righteously, and to ship those things into Africa to the African folk there, where we already had shipped those things in. So we had two sources of supply independent of each other coming into Africa, and that disturbed us because we felt they were just disorderly and out of place. We said nothing, however, about it, but Brother Sara wrote to several independent people of each other in Africa and asked them to translate the message into Zulu, post the translations back to them, and they would set them up and begin to ship this material into Africa. Now, Brother Luvu is a man that understands gospel order very, very well, and he saw that this was only going to cause confusion. He wrote to me at once, quite distressed, and said, by the right, he said, what's going on here, he said. He said, if I come into a disorderly movement, a disorganized movement, he said. He said, is this consistent with the message of living righteousness? He says, how does Brother Sara know that this one or that one has a good knowledge of English? Or this one or that one understands the message? Why, he said, there are men here in Africa, he said, are all too ready to take up a work like this without being qualified for it. He said, to my mind, he said, the word of God would require Brother Sara to work through somebody here who does know what's going on this field and who has sound judgment and can work this thing out. And that, of course, was quite right. I had to agree 100% with Brother Luber's position. And so I wrote to Brother Seiler and laid these things before him. He never replied to me. But at the same time, apparently he quit trying to get translations in that way and did ask Brother Lubu himself to supply them, which Brother Lubu did turn around and do for him. However, the Silas never did print the African material. It was finally done all over again and sent to us. And here I have some samples of Zulu in my hand. We brought them across so you folk could try out your hand at reading this rather interesting language. So far, I haven't seen you folk really getting stuck into these, but don't miss the opportunity of reading them through before the camp is over. So much for that. And the next thing which disturbed us was the fact that Wolfgang Meyer is the man of God's choosing in Germany. He carries every mark of being called of God, and we have satisfied ourselves in that question, and Wolfgang enjoys our complete respect, support and cooperation, and we've handed over the German field to him. And when we hand over the German field to Wolfgang, we hand it over to him, and my anxiety now is to see that Wolfgang's standing and position in Germany rates as high as possible so that the people can respect him and be blessed by his ministry and led by him. And consequently, while it is true that we print masses of German material, here for instance is the German Sabbath tract, of which we sent 2,000 up to Europe a few weeks ago, we do not send a single copy of this material direct to any individual in Germany, even though I have the addresses or could get the addresses of practically all the German folk. We send it to Wolfgang, and he in turn distributes to the people, and thus the people recognize the fact that there's complete harmony of action and unity between Wolfgang and ourselves, but not the Silas. What they did was they shipped a supply to Wolfgang, and then independent of him would make themselves a source of supply for all of Europe, circularizing Europe with their own advertising material and having folk write direct to them for individual copies of the literature. Thus they set themselves up as a controlling, organizing body and overseer of the work in Europe. So we had two different headquarters for the work in Europe, and that to us again was disorderly. And of course I mentioned these things to them, but they just felt that I was trying to control them and to dictate to them, which of course wasn't true. Now we come back to this letter which I received from them about the Heidelberg. I arrived at their home on a Thursday night, snowing and cold outside, and the first night I was there they had some pretty sharp criticism to make on me because of one or two little things which displeased them. I'll tell you what they were. I just mentioned this to include the entire story. Now, they had sent down to us the German masters. Now, the word master means, you saw in the film the other night how Christine types the two columns. Well, the good column, the one with the double justified margin straight on both sides, is what we call the master, because that's the master copy from which we take the photographs and print the work. And if we have a master in any language at all, it doesn't matter. Now, all this is sent to us already in typewritten form, and we just photograph it exactly as he does it in Africa and print it therefrom. He sends it to the masters, and this is the copies from the master. Now, they sent the master down to us wrapped with meticulous care. We photographed them, and one of the folk in the office, possibly Kay, I don't know for certain, it doesn't really matter, had mailed them back to them at their request without being as meticulously careful in the returning as they had been being sent down. And didn't Brother Silas dress me down over that? Well, I said to him, when I finally got a word in edgeways, I said, Brother Silas, we're very sorry about that. You have to recognize the fact that when we start to work together, we have to learn each other's ways and what you expect of us and so on. And I said, now that we know, I said, you can trust us to take special care about this, and in future, all your masters will come back exactly as you'd like to have them. I said, I'm very sorry about the past. Please forgive us and trust us to do better in the future. And we did. Now, what more could I do than that? Nothing more than that. But I felt he was rather unreasonable in the way in which he sailed into us as if we were just babes and dunderheads and so forth. He also complained about the wrapping of some literature which we sent up, in which the sea air had rusted some of the staples at the back, a new development which we'd never struck before or since, and he thought we should wrap everything in plastic and so on. Well, to come to the real story, next day, this of course didn't create too good a fellowship, mind you, And the next day he took me up to Montreal and showed to me a little offset printing press which could be had for $2,000, which he wished me to buy for him. Well, I didn't sort of jump at the proposition because I had some misgivings about things by this time. Anyway, I couldn't just hand out $2,000, even if I did have it. To him, I'd have to counsel with others on the question first. So then he got me in the car and he talked to me along these lines. And this is what really caused me to be concerned. He started off by spending the best part of an hour in telling me story after story after story as to how God spoke to him individually and personally, and how he never did a single thing unless the voice of God said, do this or do that. The same as you may say to your child, do this or do the other thing. Now, I can't recall all the stories that he told, but I do remember one in particular which serves to illustrate the rest. He said to me, one day I was working away in the office there, and the last thought in my mind was the preparation of the cover for the booklet Von der Knechtschaft zur Befreiung, which is the German title for From Bondage to Deliverance. And he said, all of a sudden I got a message from God, a direct impression, to stop what I was doing and do that. So I did. I instantly obeyed the voice of God, he said, and I prepared that cover. And I had only just finished when the man from Gestetner came down with his Gestafax machine, and I was able to prepare that cover on the spot in the few moments he was there. Now, he said, if I hadn't obeyed the voice of God, he said, I'd have had to go all the way up to Montreal, wasting time and money to get that done, and the work would have been delayed. So he said, do you see how it is that God speaks to me directly and personally? And when he told me all these stories, he then turned around to me and said, and now, he said, I have a message for you from God. God has told me to tell you not to buy the Heidelberg. Well, that was something, wasn't it? That immediately imposed upon me, and mind you, I didn't just dismiss the thing lightly, because maybe God had spoken to him and given me a message, and I had to consider that fact, and consider it very, very carefully. And so I weighed the matter up, and two statements, or one statement in particular, stood out in my mind, and the fact which I later read in this statement also stood out in my mind. The first statement was that God is not leading a stray individual here and there, but he is leading out a movement of people. And always in the past I had been so very, very careful to do nothing of any consequence or importance or anything at all for that matter unless I knew that the people of God stood with me in that thing. Because I certainly believe with all my heart that God just does not speak to me independent of and contrary to the experience of the church itself. As I read here, God does not give one man, and I might put in here, not even me, a knowledge of his will for the entire church while the church, Christ's body, is left in darkness. That's a very sound principle. A little further down it says, there have ever been in the church those who are constantly inclined toward individual experience. They seem unable to realize that independence of spirit is liable to lead the human agent to have too much confidence in himself and to trust in his own judgment rather than to respect the counsel and highly esteem the judgment of his brethren, especially of those in the offices God has appointed for the leadership of his people. Now, independence of action is a very, very perilous thing. It always leads to pride. That spirit will always lead to pride and self-exaltation. Well, now, here was the situation. Here was a man telling me he had a personal, direct message from God to say we shouldn't buy the Heidelberg. On the contrary, behind me, I saw months and months and months of patience waiting upon God, not by just one individual, but by a company of godly men who had proved themselves over not just a month or two, but over many, many years to be strong and faithful and true in the message. Now, which does reason indicate I should take as being the voice of God to me? The answer is obvious, isn't it? As obvious as can be. Well, we had a little discussion about it there, and then we had to hurry home for Sabbath. And on Sunday, we had quite a little meeting, and we spent the whole day there, and throughout the whole day, I talked to them and tried very hard to have them understand the peril of listening to impressions and such like as being the voice of God necessarily. Now, I'll never forget the experience I had with our friend, which particularly made me alert in regard to this thing. You know, of course, in the spirit of prophecy, there are many statements which say that never again will there come to the people of God a message based on definite time. You know there are statements which say that there'll be false prophets who will predict the time of Christ coming right down to the end, who will set a date for Christ coming. Then when that time draws near and it's plain he won't come, then they'll set a new date, then another date, and another date, and another date, until finally the Lord will come before their final expectations and they'll be caught by surprise. Well, back in 1964, Al Fenn said in the autumn of the fall of 1964, Christ was coming. Well, as the time drew near, it was plain he wasn't going to come then. So he said, I've made a mistake, it's 1971. And now he said, this is it. I know he said it because I was with him. He was really sure that this was it, 1971, the Lord was coming. And he had all kinds of calculations and figures to prove his point, and there it was. So I said to myself, well, we'll just wait for 1971, and then our friend will be proved to be a false prophet. But lo and behold, I come to America this year, and what's he done? He's got a new date still further on. And thus he exactly fulfills the prophecy. Well, I opened up the spirit of prophecy here and said to our friend, now look, I said to him, you tell me Christ is coming in 1971, or 1964 first of all, now 1971. And I said, what do you do about these statements? He looked at me and smiled and said, Fred, he said, and closed the book in my hand. I know those statements are there, he said. I know every one of them. I've had them put to me by people again and again and again. But, he said, they were written 100 years ago. And God has come down and told me personally when Christ is coming. And so he said, I will take the voice of God before I'll take the written word. Now, that is the spirit of the papacy wherein a man places himself above the word of God, isn't it? He is wiser than Daniel, wiser than Sister White, wiser than all the prophets. And so when I found the silos with the same attitude and disposition, then of course all kinds of red lights went on in my mind, warning lights and so forth, and I regarded this as being but a repetition of that same thing. Now all day Sunday I laboured very hard to get across to them the danger of such an attitude, of such a way of being led, and I can tell you to this day that I know that not one word that I spoke ever got across to their ears. They were either too busy thinking about something else or trying to think up their own arguments or something. I just know they never heard a word I said, and I told them so too, and I never denied it either. Well, just the same, I felt that things could be worked out, ever hopeful. When I finally give a person up, well, honestly, that person, I can't do anything more for them. And on that day, toward the end of the day, Brother Siler promised me faithfully he would do several things. I said to him, now look, we have been waiting for 2 years to get a master of the German von der Knechtschaft zur Befreiung, which of course is from bondage to deliverance. He said, you mean you haven't got it yet? I said, no. Well, he said, look, he said, in 1 week from now, it'll be in your office in Australia. In 1 week. I said, wonderful. At long last we'll have it. In addition, he promised to translate the Judgment of the Living, and he promised to translate the Church of God is not Babylon. He picked out from his shelves a big stack of material which he'd printed and promised me that would be mailed to Australia right away and be there when I got down home again in about 6 weeks from that point of time. So feeling that, it would all work out, I left and went off to Europe and spent the next few weeks in Germany and in Norway. And while there, Brother Lenkor from Kempten in the south of Germany, from the Schwarzwald, came to me and said he'd read the Gerecht des Leben series, that's Living Righteously, in the German, and he felt that if that was only put together into a single book with illustrations and a nice cover and maybe a different name, he could sell it very successfully as a Colporter book to the general public in Germany. Well, of course, that was a very attractive thought to us, and I thought to myself, wonderful. Well, I said, we'll go to work and do it. And so at once I wrote to the Silers, being anxious to demonstrate to them that, we still believe they could come good, and asked them, would they be prepared to do the master work and ship it down to us, and we would then print it and send it up to Europe. And they wrote back most enthusiastically and said they'd be glad to do it. Just send the stuff across to them and they go to work on it right away. Have it done in no time. So I said, when I get to Australia, I said, I'll work over the revisions and the additions and you can have it. So I came back to Australia 6 weeks after I had seen them. When I got back, I said to my wife, now I said, let's get busy and print the German from bondage. And she said, well, it isn't here yet. I said, you mean that? She said, yes, it isn't here yet. Well, I said, Silas promised me faithfully to be down here in 1 week. Well, I said, it'll come in a few days for sure. But the camp went by and it didn't come. So I wrote to the silo and I asked them urgently to send it down because we were waiting for it, to which I got no reply. But by this time, I began to get rather suspicious that they were determined to take a course of complete independence and just go their own way and do just as they liked. Now, we have no disposition to rule them, but we do expect that they'll work with us. And they'll respect our work just as we respect their work. So the second, I then wrote back to them again, and this time I expressed to them my concern over the fact that every indication was that they felt that they were going to go on an independent course and just go their own way. Now I said, if you wish to do that, I said, that's your freedom. But we have a contract with you to publish what you translate. And I said, we can't break our side of the contract until we know for certain that you have withdrawn from yours. So I said, please, I said, let us know. And then I said, we can look around and find another translator, other typesetters, and go on with the work on our own. And in the same letter, I gave them reasons as to why I began to fear that they had chosen to ignore us completely and just go their own independent course. And I listed these promises which they had promised to fulfill, none of which had been fulfilled, how they'd broken their contract, put us in the lurch, and how they'd done things in Africa and so forth. Well, this time I got a reply. It was very brief and went like this. It simply said, we have received your letter and we have noticed its contents and your charges. And there were no charges. There were just simply reasons given as to why I had come to believe that they wanted to go independent, which I gave them the freedom to do. They said, now look, they said, we are called of God and we receive direct directions from God in all that we do. Therefore, God is responsible for all that we do, and it's no good bringing your complaints to us, they said. We won't even consider them or answer them. You go to God with your complaints about us and tell him about them, let him answer you. Now I thought of Adam in the Garden of Eden at once where he said, this woman whom you gave me caused me to sin. And I thought to myself, did the Lord cause the silence to make all these promises and then just ignore them and break them? Did he lead them to take up the work of printing our material and our literature which we had written and published independent of us without our direct permission? Because the author, an author has the right of copyright over his material. The message is anybody's message, but your writings of it are your property, and that's proved by the fact that every one of Sister White's books were copyrighted by her herself. So therefore, if she had the right to do it, we have the right to do it too. And then they said to me, now you go to God and ask him about this thing, and when you have received your answer from him in regard to us, and come out in the newsletter and proclaim that there is a publishing house in Canada, and tell the people, in effect, what God has told you about this publishing house. Well, we took that letter and laid it out before the Lord. We studied it. We prayed about it. We considered the whole thing carefully. And then we complied with their request to announce in the newsletter what we discovered as a result of our study of their situation, which newsletter, of course, all you folk have read. And I tell you this, that I am certainly glad now that we did put that thing in the newsletter when we did, because I have gained information from the length and breadth of America showing how that forestalled a number of moves which would have really made the situation far worse than it actually was. Well, that virtually sums the story up, because any correspondence after that between themselves and us was only a determined effort upon their part to justify their course of action, and they maintained that the real issue was the fact that we would not accept them as a direct voice of God to this movement, virtually as a prophet of the movement. And that's the issue. In the last letter which I got, he spent pages and pages trying to justify the fact that when God spoke to him and said we shouldn't buy the Heidelberg, that we should have obeyed that voice, that he was the only one right and all the rest of us were wrong. Well now, the sequel to the story is this, that eventually then I wrote to them and told them, we drew up a little letter, which I have a copy of upstairs, I should have brought it down, in which I told them that we did not recognize them as being called of God, and that anything they did in the future was without any support or blessing from us, and therefore we took the stand of withdrawing all support from them altogether, and that that included permission to publish our material. I said, if you want to publish the message, you go ahead and publish it. But our writings of it, I said, that is, it's our prerogative to decide who shall publish those and so forth. Well, the latest thing is this now, that they've taken the stand now that all the light which we have received in the last 15 years is only second-hand 1888 message. And what they will do is go back, they'll reject all this, and they'll go back to Wagner and Jones themselves, and they'll publish Wagner and Jones, and they'll get the message first-hand. Now, what they failed to recognize is the fact that when the Adventist Church rejected Wagner and Jones, they rejected the beginning of the light, which was to come to them as a people. And when the message came back to us, and we took up that which was revealed to Wagner and Jones, and right away, God began to reveal to us the continuation of that light, which began back in 1888. And today, as you folk recognize, we have light which takes us a long way beyond where Wagner and Jones left off. Isn't that true? So that what they are doing is making the time-honored mistake of rejecting the message and the messenger of today while they profess to revere the messenger of the past. The very same mistake that we read in the Bible today where it said in regard to the Pharisees, they said, Moses, we believe God did speak through him, but as for this fellow, Christ, where does he come from? We don't recognize him. Which just shows that if they had lived back in at the same time in 1888, then it would have been the same difficulty. Now you recall that splendid statement we quoted in the newsletter from Testminster Ministers, page 28 to 29, which says, angels work harmoniously. Perfect order characterizes all their movements. The more closely we imitate the harmony and order of the angelic host, the more successful will be the efforts of those heavenly agents on our behalf. If we see no necessity for harmonious action and disorderly, undisciplined and disorganized, I beg your pardon, and are disorderly, undisciplined, and disorganized in our course of action, angels who are thoroughly organized and move in perfect order cannot work for us successfully. They turn away in grief, for they are not authorized to bless confusion, distraction, and disorganization. All who desire the cooperation of the heavenly messengers must work in unison with them. Those who have the unction from on high will in all their efforts encourage order, discipline and union of action, and then the angels of God can cooperate with them. But never, never will these heavenly messengers place their endorsement upon irregularity, disorganization, and disorder. All these evils are the result of Satan's efforts to weaken our forces, to destroy our courage, and prevent successful action. Satan well knows that success can only attend order and harmonious action. He well knows that everything connected with heaven is in perfect order, that subjection and perfect discipline like the movements of the angelic host. It is his studied effort to lead professed Christians just as far from heaven's arrangement as he can. Therefore, he deceives even the professed people of God and makes them believe that order and discipline are enemies of spirituality, that the only safety for them is to let each pursue his own course, and to remain especially distinct from bodies of Christians who are united and are laboring to establish discipline and harmony of action. All the efforts made to establish order are considered dangerous, a restriction of rightful freedom, and hence are feared as popery. These devoted souls consider it a virtue to boast of their freedom to think and act independently. They will not take any man say so. They are amenable to no man. I was shown that it is Satan's special work to lead men to feel that it is God's order for them to strike out for themselves and choose their own course independent of their brethren. And that was the problem with the Silas. Now, we never ever, in any sense of the word, desired to rule over them. Wolfgang in Germany is there, and he and I work in the most perfect and happy unity you could wish for. I couldn't ask for anything better than Wolfgang's cooperation. Now, how is it achieved? Simply by this. I absolutely respect his position and he respects mine. I never in the least degree try and usurp anything which is his prerogative. When I go to Europe, as far as I'm concerned, he is the leader, he is the man in charge, and I go there as his servant. I don't try and tell him what to do, take over his work, run across purposes to him, duplicate what he's doing. I simply go there as his servant to help him in his work. And if he came to Australia, then it'd be the other way about. And you might say, well, the language makes you do it that way. Don't you believe it? Because in Africa, they mostly speak English. And when I go to Africa, then I go there, and Brother Luvu and Brother Sesetzi are my masters. I do as they wish me to do, go where they direct me to go, and we worked together in the most perfect harmony. And Silas could have found the same harmony if they would, but no, they wanted to feel that nobody knew anything but themselves, that they should impose their will upon the entire church, that they could take up a work which others were already doing, and just work in an irregular and disorderly way wherever they went. And as we've learned from the study of the last few days, that the most basic laws of heaven is not just simply working for God, but it is to understand the principles whereby we work together with each other and with God. And there's a big difference, isn't there? So that's the problem in just a few simple words. And that is why the Silas today are no longer working with us. We regret it because they are wonderful help while they were working with us. As I said, they were tremendous workers. They had wonderful talent and skill, and no sacrifice was too great. But sad to say, they marred it all by a spirit of independent action and by making the sad mistake that they had a direct mission from God, and God favored them above all the rest of the world and spoke to them directly. Now mark this thought finally, and that is this, that in heaven, Lucifer was the most talented of all the angels and the hardest working. And Lucifer had the idea in his mind that those talents and those abilities made up for any other deficiencies in his work and compensated for his activity. He thought he was safe in going around spreading discontent because he said, God will never dispense with me, I'm too valuable. But he made the mistake of his life. Because the more talented and hard-working a person is, if they don't have the mind of Christ, then the more dangerous those people are, and the sooner they are no longer in a position of opportunity where they can do harm to the cause of God, the better. Isn't that true? And that's why God put Lucifer out of heaven, because his very talents, once he lost the mind of Christ, made him the most dangerous person that heaven contained, the most dangerous. More so perhaps than all his angels put together. There you are now. That completes all my storytelling for this year. I don't enjoy telling these stories, but because they are things we have to face, we have to tell them and evaluate them for what they are. And if you have any questions, then feel free to ask them. One thing is very sure, I shall never make a move. Now, here's one thing. Perhaps I should just put this on the tape too, perhaps. Here's one thing that I honestly can say fills me with fear. I have the fear that I will make the tragic mistake of someday opposing a man whom God has really sent. If I do, it won't be new, because that has been a mistake of men in the past whom God has called, isn't it? Hasn't it been? And because I have that fear, I am very, very careful to reserve my judgment until the evidence is so plain that a person is out of tune with God and his people that I know I'm making no mistake in taking that stand. And my wife will bear me up when I say that of all the people in Australia, I was the last one of all the church who finally submitted in my recognition that Bevan de Ruyter was not a man of God's calling. The last. Because I feared that maybe we were making a mistake and that we shouldn't be too hasty in making our judgment. But when the evidence became so plain and I couldn't deny it, then finally I said, well, I must agree with the rest, that he's not a man of God. And likewise with the Silas, I believe we went not just the second, we went the third and fourth mile before finally we got to the place where we were forced to demand of them what they're going to do. And I must remind you that their response in the end was to declare that they wanted to be independent of the rest of us. Now, verbally they'll deny that. They'll say, no, we never wanted that. But their actions and their refusal to come out clean and say, yes, we will work with you in proper cooperation, was in itself a declaration that they would go completely independent of the rest of the church. Well, if they want to be a movement of their own, that's their freedom. If they want to stay up there in Canada now and print 10,000 books, that's their freedom. We won't go and burn their publishing house down. We won't go around and raise a campaign to stop them getting money or anything like that. That's their freedom. But we won't support them in it. We have no part nor parcel with them. What they do now is their responsibility, and they have to answer to God for that for themselves. I said the other day to define and punish heresy is one of the most deep-seated of the papal errors. But to define heresy and to withdraw your support from it is the duty of a Christian. See the distinction? It's a very important distinction. Not without our permission. Mm-hmm.